Our next case this morning is in the matter of UAL Corporation. We hold on for a second till the need to call it a commotion, and hard to think that United's bankruptcy would drive this many people away. All right, Mr. Cheever, let's proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. I am George Cheever. I am appearing on behalf of State Street Bank and Trust Company, which is the trustee of the United Airlines Corporation Employee Stock Ownership Plan, and the appellant here today. The genesis of this appeal is an order entered by the bankruptcy court in UAL's bankruptcy proceeding. That injunction prevented the sale by State Street of the stock that was held in trust for the ESOP participants. State Street maintains on this appeal.
Of course, the injunction is dead.
Yes.
Right. The ESOP is gone.
Yes. And UAL.
So why isn't this case moot?
It is not moot because of the possibility of the remedy of restitution. UAL was.
What's your best authority for the view that in a case with no injunction bond, a monetary payment can nonetheless be required from the injunction winner to the injunction loser?
Well, the most recent case at the Court of Appeals level that has addressed this issue is the Texas-Puerto Rico case from the First Circuit in 1995. That case did not award damages, but it certainly...
That's why I'm asking you for your best case for the proposition that damages can be awarded. Now, I'm not aware of any case where monetary compensation has been awarded. We can dispute whether it's damages, restitution, unjust enrichment, and so on. Are there any that you know of ever?
Well, there is the case involving wages that were paid that were not paid because of an injunction and that were required to be paid in full over and above the amount of the bonds that had been posted by the party seeking that injunction. And I can find you the name of that case if you'll give me a second.
I take it that this was sums due on other grounds.
There was other grounds? No, the facts of the case were that an injunction was obtained.
If there's a contract, the wages are paid under a contract. If there's a contract that says A owes X to B, and that contract is enjoined for a period of time and the injunction is lifted, then you still have to pay under the contract.
Well, the court in that case applied the doctrine of restitution. It did not apply principles of contract law. I'm not sure there was a contract. That's a fact I frankly don't remember from the case. I think it was simply a question of whether the employer was required to pay wages at a certain level or whether it could pay wages lower than that level. The source of the requirement that wages be paid was a law, a minimum wage law. In any event, I mean, there are plenty of cases across the land that have recognized that restitution is an appropriate remedy when an injunction has been wrongfully entered.
Since so far you've given me zero citations, plenty of cases seems an overstatement.
Well, the Arkadelphia case from the Supreme Court at least pronounces that principle. Each of these cases does turn on its own facts. The fact that there has never been a case exactly like this doesn't seem to me to be dispositive. This is not a novel principle. This is a principle that has evolved over hundreds of years. It is crystallized in the Restatement of Restitution, which was adopted almost 70 years ago. And I think it is well understood. The essence of it is that if a party has been wronged by an order or an injunction, he's entitled to be restored to what he lost. To some extent,
that simply amounts to disagreement with the rule that the compensation for a wrongful injunction can't exceed the bond. And if that were the norm, the rule I've articulated would not be the rule. It just wouldn't exist. Because the whole point of an injunction bond is to recognize that the wrongful injunction may injure one party to the benefit of the other. Right? And on your view, there simply wouldn't be a rule that the compensation is limited to the amount of the bond. Indeed, the bond would just be a means of backing up, securing payment of obligations that are independently payable. But that's a pretty old rule, which you're telling us effectively doesn't exist.
Well, I don't think it's true that the doctrine of restitution completely displaces that old rule. For one thing, you can look at the doctrine of restitution and tie it to the question of unjust enrichment and limit its application to cases in which it is demonstrable that the party seeking the injunction, the wrongful injunction, has been unjustly enriched.
That doesn't limit the rule at all. That expands it so that, as Judge Easterbrook was mentioning, it essentially swallows the entire rule. The restitution exception, if it's interpreted as broadly as you're arguing here, to cover any instance of unjust enrichment, which is always implicit where an injunction is wrongly granted, or at least could arguably be implicit.
Well, there are
then the restitution exception, as you're arguing, swallows the rule.
Well, there are cases that have pushed the doctrine even further. I point you to Citronelle and Selbert, which are discussed in our briefs. These are cases in which the court has said it's not necessary to show unjust enrichment. All that is necessary for the restitution doctrine to be available is for there to be a need to set things right. Now, I don't think this court needs to explore the outer perimeters of the restitution doctrine to decide this case in State Street's favor. I think we fall directly within the unjust enrichment rule. And this is a well-established rule. There may not be a case that's exactly on point factually, but the general pronouncement has been recognized by courts over and over again, including, as I mentioned, the Supreme Court in the Arkadelphia case.
Where can we find that case? I can't find it in your memo on mootness.
It is not cited in my brief. It is.
Then you're not
cited.
Allowed to cite it here.
Okay.
You cannot cite cases for the first time at oral argument.
All right.
We actually have a rule about this.
I beg your pardon, Your Honor.
Certainly, if you're going to cite cases for the first time at oral argument, it would help to have such things as citations.
The case is cited in the Texaco Puerto Rico case. In fact, it's cited as basically the touchstone of the restitution doctrine. The site is 249 U.S. 134. It's a 1919 decision.
249 U.S.?
Let's assume, counsel, that we recognize the sort of restitution exception to the rule about the injunction bond being the limit of what's recoverable if an injunction is reversed. What is the basis for a claim of unjust enrichment here that generally requires the conferral of a benefit, which really hasn't occurred here?
Well, it's interesting that UAL suddenly thinks and announces that this benefit has not been conferred, because if there really was no benefit conferred by this injunction, you wonder why it was issued at all. UAL
does
not
really... That's exactly the problem. You're saying that in any case in which an injunction is issued, there will be a benefit conferred, and therefore there'll be a restitution entitlement if the injunction is reversed, and therefore the old rule is just abolished. It's just turned on its head.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that the old rule addresses the question of damages, and damages in the legal sense are something that follow inexorably if wrongful injury is demonstrated. But the restitution doctrine is different, And the difference was pinpointed by the Texaco Puerto Rico case when it said that restitution is a matter of right, not a matter of right, but of sound, equitable discretion. So it is that discretion which limits the rule and means that it does not entirely displace the old rule. Now,
I'm now completely, I've now had a chance to look up the Arkadelphia case. An injunction bond was issued in Arkadelphia. What Arkadelphia was about was determining the amount of liability on the injunction bond. It's not, it doesn't suggest that you can award restitution where there was no injunction bond. It's about computation of the sum due on the bond.
Well, it certainly seemed to suggest that to the First Circuit in the Texas-Puerto Rico case, which believes that this is not simply a Rule 65-1 question. It's a question of the common law doctrine of restitution as it applies in the federal courts. Now, UAL does not really suggest that this principle of restitution doesn't exist. They would limit it to cases in which there are actual, identifiable, tangible property interests that pass from the defendant to the plaintiff in a wrongful injunction action. Clearly, such cases are within the scope of the restitution doctrine, but I don't think the doctrine is limited to those cases. I think what's important is that value passes, and value has passed here. There is no question but that the stock lost value. The ESOP participants have lost the opportunity to realize on that value. And on the other side of the coin, UAL has avoided a loss, and avoidance of a loss is a form of unjust enrichment. And the measure of the restitution remedy here might normally be the amount of that unjust enrichment. But in this case, according to UAL's own theory of the case, it's the loss avoided is by many factors higher than the loss sustained by the ESOP participants, and therefore it is the loss sustained by the ESOP participants that should be the measure of the restitutionary remedy. Does that answer your question? Okay, thank you. If there are no more questions on the mootness motion, I would like to turn, if I could, to the merits. The basic question is, what did UAL have to show in this case to get an injunction? And I think there are five factors: actual success on the merits, no adequate remedy at law, irreparable harm, a harm outweighing the irreparable harm to the other parties, and no harm to the public interest. Now, I think that actual success was clearly required in this case because this was a final injunction, and this is a point on which the parties are in disagreement. However, I think it is pretty clear that the judge thought this was a final or permanent injunction in the sense that it had provided all the relief on the question of whether or not an injunction was going to be issued that the plaintiff had asked for. It was entered after two evidentiary hearings, and no further hearings on this issue were contemplated. UAL got all that it wanted. The fact that the order was titled a preliminary injunction was, as the district court conceded, not a material fact, and the fact that it had an expiration date doesn't mean it isn't a final permanent injunction in the sense of requiring actual success on the merits. In fact, it was permanent in a very real practical sense, because although the injunction expires by its terms on the date of the effective date of the plan, by that time, UAL admits that the stock will be valueless and will be canceled. So this is as permanent as it gets. It's as permanent as the tomb. So what did actual success on the merits require? First of all, it required a showing of a legal basis for the injunction. Now, this was not shown. UAL points first to 362A, but that doesn't apply for two reasons. 362A would protect interference or prevent interference with property of the debtor. But in this case, first of all, we argue that there is no property interest here. All there is this very wispy, ephemeral tax attribute which cannot be bought or sold and that can be eliminated by the stroke of a pen. Any value that it might have is contingent on a host of events. I think that this just drops off the edge of what falls into the category of protectable property under 362. But in any event, even if it were a property interest, There would be no interference with it within the meaning of those words as used in 362A, because all that State Street did was take its own property, or more precisely the property of the ESOP participants, and sell it in the normal course of business. So this is a perfectly normal commercial activity, no different from thousands of other acts that competitors, employees, customers take every day, acts that might in some indirect way affect the estate. But surely 362A doesn't extend so far as to enjoin these acts. Otherwise, what would we do? You couldn't change fuel prices on United Airlines? Well, that would be very nice, but certainly that's not what Section 362 requires. Nor does Section 105, I think, offer any basis for this injunction, because all Section 105 does is allow you to implement the provisions of the Bankruptcy Code and enforce them. It's not a roving commission to do equity. It doesn't alter substantive rights, doesn't allow you to alter substantive rights arising under non-bankruptcy law unless you are enforcing some specific provision of the Bankruptcy Code, and there is no such provision here. There is simply nothing in the Bankruptcy Code that would authorize interference with property interests that are not property of the estate. This couldn't have happened under the old Bankruptcy Act. There's plenty of authority for that, and we've cited it in the brief. There's no reason to think that the law changed, since there isn't anything in the Bankruptcy Code that suggests otherwise, and we know from Duesma versus Trim that you shouldn't attribute an intention to change the law unless it's pretty evident from the words of the statute when a new law is enacted or displacing an old one. So Section 105 really doesn't help out here. This is not a question of jurisdiction, clearly, as the Solitex versus Edwards case indicates. The jurisdiction of the bankruptcy court to entertain this claim and consider it was expanded when the Bankruptcy Code was enacted back in 1978. But what we're talking about here is not jurisdiction, but power. That is an important distinction. What UAL had to show was a source of power for the court to do what it did, and it did not make that showing. Your Honors, I see that I'm into my rebuttal time, so I guess I will defer my remarks until that last 5 minutes.
Okay. Thank you. Certainly. The court is going to take a brief recess before continuing with the argument.
is now in session. Please be seated and come to order.
Ready to resume argument now? Mr. Slade.
Thank you. May it please the court. Your Honor hit on the threshold issue in this case, which is whether or not it's moot. State Street concedes that the injunction that is being appealed does not affect it in any way and hasn't for about 2 years. On June 27th of 2003, the IRS issued a bullet regulation which allowed State Street to distribute its stock.
What regulation?
It's codified at 26 CFR 1.38.
No, you called it.
It's a bullet regulation. Basically,
what does that mean?
There's a specific IRS procedure which allows parties to approach the IRS on an expedited basis and for it to issue regulations, basically without going through.
Give them any special legal attributes?
No, but
so it's just a regulation.
It's no more or less authoritative than any other regulation. But its effect here was to allow State Street to distribute the stock to the individual ESOP participants and for them to sell or to hold as they wished without affecting United's net operating loss. The question now is, if this injunction is dissolved, could State Street get anything? And the answer is no. As the court has hinted in its questioning, there's an injunction bond rule which prohibits claims for damages caused by an injunction in the absence of a bond. The Supreme Court stated as much in the W.R. Grace case in 1983, specifically stated that a party issued by the issuance of injunction later determined to be erroneous has no action for damages in the absence of a bond. This court adopted that statement as binding law in the Coyne Delaney case.
We don't adopt decisions of the Supreme Court. They're authoritative of their own force.
Oh, I agree with you, Your Honor, but there is some question as to whether that statement by the Supreme Court was a holding or dicta. And this court in the Coyne Delaney case made clear that that was the law it was going to enforce. In the Coyne Delaney case, the question was whether the defendant, who had been enjoined from bidding on the government contract and as a result of the injunction had suffered damages, could get anything more than the nominal injunction bond that the court had forced the plaintiff to post in that case. And this court clearly held that no damages, nothing, over and above the injunction bond could be collected. And specifically, this court held that a claim for more than the injunction bond relies on some principle of equity that the Supreme Court in W.R. Grace says does not exist. In the Coyne Delaney case, this court basically rejected the theory that State Street espouses here. What it's trying to do is create an extremely broad exception to this rule, which, as Judge Sykes's questions indicated, would basically swallow it entirely. The Coyne Delaney opinion specifically describes why that shouldn't occur, and it's because it's contrary to the American rule. In any other case, when a plaintiff files a lawsuit, if the lawsuit is not frivolous or in violation of Rule 11, the defendant, even if it wins, can only recover its statutory costs. It cannot recover damages. As this court held in the Coyne Delaney case, it just wouldn't make sense if there was a different result in injunction cases. What it would do is make plaintiffs guarantee.
Why was there no injunction bond in this case?
There was no injunction bond. The court basically, Judge Weedoff's reasoning was that it basically was a flip of a coin whether they would suffer any damages as a result of the injunction, because the stock could go up, the stock could go down based on a number of factors. And in fact, the stock actually has doubled since United went into bankruptcy in December of 2002. State Street put on a little bit of evidence. I wouldn't call it very.
I don't understand your answer.
Why
That's
wasn't
just
there
to say that there may be no damages.
Correct.
An injunction bond is something that guards against the possibility of damages. We have here a situation in which, if the ESOP is right, it's looking at substantial loss, and if United is right, United is looking at substantial gain.
arguably.
I think there are gains from trade here, right? You can easily imagine either an injunction bond or perhaps a 362D adequate protection agreement, so that if United's gains exceed the ESOP's losses, United has to make compensation. Now, of course, you might phrase it the other way around, so that if the ESOP has gains, it has to pay United. But the fact that there might not be any loss has not traditionally been a reason for denying a bond that will protect against the loss if it occurs.
Well, Your Honor, Bankruptcy Rule 7065 makes the Rule 65C bonding requirement optional. It specifically says that the bankruptcy court does not have to issue a bond if a debtor seeks an injunction. And here, Judge Weedoff's reasoning was that the injunction was meant to be temporary. United always intended to do everything it could to try to allow State Street to sell its stock. And because of that, Judge Weedoff held that there basically wasn't any evidence that State Street would lose anything during the time period that the injunction was into effect. And frankly, we don't believe they did lose anything. So the answer to your question as to why the bankruptcy court didn't require an injunction bond was because it didn't believe that there was any risk of loss due to the injunction it was entering.
Oh, that's a completely different statement from the one you first made. Didn't think there was any risk of loss.
Well,
he thought there was no risk. He was a fool. And Judge Weedoff is no fool.
Your Honor,
he perceived there was a risk, surely.
Sure, there was some risk, but the evidence didn't really indicate whether or not the stock would go up or down.
Was there a request made to the district court or this court to order a bond?
No, there wasn't, Your Honor. And that's what I believe fundamentally State Street did wrong here. What they should have done is exactly what this court told them to do in the Coyne Delaney case. This court said that what State Street should have done is file a motion with the district court immediately after it appealed for expedited treatment of its appeal and a specific request for a bond. State Street didn't appeal the lack of a bond at all, let alone do what this court instructed to do in the Coyne Delaney case. So in our view, that's fairly dispositive of the question of whether or not a bond could have been or could be required now. In addition, this court held in the Meade-Johnson case that it's inappropriate to change the terms of bond or to order a bond or to increase the amount of a bond after an injunction has been dissolved on appeal. Specifically, this court held that it basically just didn't make any sense. Once the injunction is no longer into effect, changing the bond doesn't do anything. And unless the court has any more questions on the mootness issue, I'll move on to the merits. Now, we don't believe that the court should reach the merits because, as we've described, the State Street can't receive any relief even if they succeed on appeal. But if it does, what the bankruptcy court did here was fundamental to the bankruptcy court's function. When you have property of the estate, the bankruptcy court's job is to protect that asset so it can be used in the best interests of all creditors. That's exactly what Judge Weedoff did here. Now, the first statute that we point to as power for Judge Weedoff to issue that injunction was Section 362A3 of the Bankruptcy Code, which bars act that would do one of three things: that would obtain possession of property of the estate, obtain property from the estate, or exercise control over property of the estate. There isn't really any question, in our view, that the net operating losses that United has are property of the estate. And in fact, in the district court, State Street conceded that the net operating losses were property of the estate. This is the first time that State Street is contesting that issue at all, and with good reason. 541A1 of the Bankruptcy Code makes clear that property of the estate includes all legal and equitable interests of the debtor. That was necessarily and intentionally broad. The legislative history and the Supreme Court's decision in the Whiting Pools case make clear that 541A1 specifically was intended to put everything possible, all possible interest in property into the bankruptcy estate to allow a debtor to reorganize. Now, this court in the Luster case, which its opinion said was a case of first and last impression, considered a totally different question. The question there was whether an NOL carry forward was property of the estate under the 1898 Bankruptcy Act, which isn't applicable here. In that case, this court held that NOL carryforwards were not property of the estate under that act because that act required assets to be transferable or alienable to be qualified as property of the estate. That is no longer a condition of the bankruptcy code. In fact, 541A1 rejects that condition. And that's why we cite a number of cases in our brief where NOL carryforwards have been held to be property of the estate under numerous circumstances. The question then becomes whether or not Section 362A3 of the Bankruptcy Code bars State Street from trying to exercise control over property of the estate. Now, that clause has to be read to the exclusion of the previous two in the statute. Specifically, exercising control over an asset has to be something different and distinct from trying to obtain possession of state property or trying to obtain property from the estate. In fact, that last clause, exercising control over the estate, was actually added later as part of the 1984 bankruptcy amendments because Congress wanted to broaden the bankruptcy court's power to protect estate assets. A dictionary definition or any definition of exercising control would be exercising a restraining or directing influence over an estate asset. We're talking about property of the estate, and State Street wants to take action that would essentially limit United's ability to use a critical estate asset. The Second Circuit in the Prudential Alliance case held that it clearly fell within the bailiwick of 362A3, and it's right on point. Now, this court's decision in the Martin Trigonia case is not to the contrary. When this court ruled that 362A3 wasn't violated when a defendant in a lawsuit simply filed a motion to dismiss that lawsuit, that what the defendant in that case was not trying to exercise control over estate property. That defendant was simply trying to say that estate property did not exist. Now, the injunction of the bankruptcy court...
Explain how the sale of stock can exercise control over the loss carryforwards. I understand how that was possible in Prudential. You had corporations that used to be filing joint tax returns. Single corporate groups split up, and one of the corporations actually tried to use the loss carryforwards to cover its own profits.
That's not exactly right. In the Prudential,
close enough for government work.
Your Honor, in the
there's no claim here that there's to be any use of the loss carryforwards, and of course the ESOP was not exactly part of a corporate group with United.
But in Prudential, it's precisely the same question, Your Honor. In the Prudential Lines case, the parent company was trying to take a different stock deduction, which would have, by definition, under the tax laws, eliminated or mitigated the subsidiary corporation of the debtor, which was the debtor, from using its NOLs. That's exactly the same question we're considering here, which is whether a third-party act would, under the operation of the tax laws, severely minimize United's ability to use its NOLs. And the evidence at trial indicated that if State Street were permitted to do what it wanted to do, then United would have lost all but 2% of its net operating losses. Now, the bankruptcy court's injunction was supplemented by Section 105A of the Bankruptcy Code. Courts routinely use Section 105 to enjoin activities that threaten a bankruptcy estate. 105 operates in tandem with the Section 362A3, which is exactly the reasoning that Judge Darragh employed at the district court level. The Celotex case from the Supreme Court makes clear that a Florida bankruptcy court had jurisdiction to enter a 105 injunction to protect a bankruptcy estate.
The Celotex case expressly reserves the question whether the entry of the injunction was proper.
That's true. But the
Celotex case presents the question whether the entry of the injunction was proper.
I think that
the only issue in Celotex is the collateral bar doctrine.
I agree with you, Your Honor, that there wasn't an express decision in Celotex that a Section 105 injunction was inappropriate. But there was a decision in that case that the court had jurisdiction to enter the 105 injunction, the Florida Bankruptcy Court in this case.
Jurisdiction is not the question.
Okay, well, this court...
The question is whether the court was right.
Well, let's talk about, Your Honor...
And on that question, Celotex, that is the question reserved in Celotex.
Well, let's talk about...
Not the question resolved in Celotex.
I apologize, Judge. Let's talk about this court's decision in the Fisher case. In the Fisher case, this court held that that Section 105 of the Bankruptcy Court empowered a bankruptcy judge to enjoin a lawsuit by a non-debtor against a non-debtor.
Have you read the Kmart decision?
I have, Your Honor.
Your brief doesn't discuss it.
Well, we do cite the Kmart decision.
We discuss at length in Kmart what Section 105 can be used for, and it's... I must say, it's very hard to reconcile your position with what we said in Kmart.
I don't think that's necessarily so, Your Honor. In Kmart, this court held that 105 of the Bankruptcy Code could not be used to contradict other sections of the Bankruptcy Code. Specifically, you couldn't use Section 105 of the Bankruptcy Code to alter the absolute priority scheme. That's not the case here. What Judge Dweedoff did, as he expressly stated in his opinion, is much more similar to what this court did in the Fisher case, which was entering an injunction barring a lawsuit by a non-debtor against a non-debtor that the court agreed was not property of the estate. This court specifically found that the case was not property of the estate, but it could enter an injunction staying that case because it was related to property of the estate and may affect property of the estate. That's exactly what Judge Weedoff did here. It comes directly from this court's opinion in the Fisher case, and we don't believe it's distinguishable. As for the evidence, Mr. Cheever mentioned that he believed the injunction was a permanent one, and therefore United had to satisfy additional hurdles before the injunction was entered. That's not an argument they made to Judge Weedoff. They never told Judge Weedoff that they thought he was entering a permanent injunction, and accordingly that United had to prove actual success on the merits. But even if he had done that, the evidence is undisputed. The only evidence that was presented in this case that related at all to United's existence and ability to use its NOLs was evidence that United presented. It presented testimony from its CFO, Frederick Brace, from its vice president and treasurer, Jeff Kowalski, and from David Lieb, who's the man that at the time ran United's financial and business model. Then the combined testimony from those three gentlemen established that United had NOLs and that based on its business plan at that time, United expected to use those NOLs in upcoming years. That's the only evidence that could have been required to prove even the standard that Mr. Cheever suggests should exist. If there's any question about the evidence in this case, I would ask the panel to look at pages 1052 through 1063 of the appendix. Those are the slides of evidence that we presented at the February 21st evidentiary hearing, and those alone should be dispositive of that question. As to whether the injunction was preliminary or permanent, the answer is also answered given by just looking at the order itself. The order itself explicitly contemplates future hearings if State Street had decided it wanted to sell more shares of stock. All State Street needed to do in that circumstance was fill out the forms that the order attaches, send them to United, saying we would like to sell more stock. United would have had to prove again that it fulfilled the requirements of the Bankruptcy Code and the federal rules. State Street's last argument is that the injunction operated as some sort of a taking of its property without just compensation. As we pointed out in our brief, and I'll be brief on this, that argument doesn't make any sense for a number of reasons. In the Andrews versus Allard case, the Supreme Court held that restrictions on the sale of property do not operate as takings compensable under the Fifth Amendment. This case is of like mind, and I don't think the takings argument should distract this court at all. If the court doesn't have any more questions, I would just ask that it dismiss State Street's appeal as moot, or in the alternative,
no,
that the
don't
court
dismiss appeals as moot. You order the underlying judgment vacated.
Order the underlying judgment vacated. I'm not sure I follow that. The underlying judgment against State Street.
We don't need to explore why the Supreme Court held what it held in United States against Munsingware, but that is, in fact, the settled doctrine.
Okay. The point, Your Honor, that I need to make sure the panel understands is that this order, it still exists. It's in force. It just doesn't affect State Street at all.
No, it will be vacated. If this case is moot, the order will be vacated.
Okay. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Mr. Slade. Mr. Cheever.
Thank you, Your Honors. The citation I was fumbling for earlier is Mitchell versus Regal Textile, Inc. It's 259 Fed Second 954. It's a D.C. Circuit case decided
in 1950. Could you speak up, please?
I beg your pardon. Mitchell versus Regal Textile, Inc., 259 Fed Second 954, D.C. Circuit, 1958. It is an old case, but it does follow the notion that restitution is an available remedy in the case of a wrongful injunction. On this subject, I will say only one thing.
There's no doubt about that from Arkadelphia, but we've been through this before. Arkadelphia said that restitution is a theory of damages to be awarded under an injunction bond. It didn't say that it was a theory that allows one to ignore the lack of an injunction bond.
Well, in Mitchell, there was
an
injunction bond.
I've been asking all along about your best authority for the proposition that the absence of an injunction bond is irrelevant.
Well, I think Mitchell does stand for that proposition obliquely in the sense that there was an injunction bond, and the lower court had thought that was the limit of damages, and the Court of Appeals said no. There is something else that can be obtained here by the wronged party over and above what the injunction bond provided for. So it does seem to me that that does support State Street's position. What I had started to say, however, is in response, I think, to your basic concern, I do think that this old doctrine actually masks a change in the law. There is a change in the law reflected in cases like Texas, Puerto Rico. We are a more complex and litigious society, and I think courts have begun to recognize that the old rule works some substantial injustices, and that rule is changing. I'd like to turn now to the question of adequate protection. I think that the district court's handling of this issue is one of the most troubling aspects of its opinion. The district court said, although State Street provided evidence that United Stock would become virtually worthless by the time it emerged from bankruptcy, the bankruptcy court was entitled to discount this evidence. Instead, the bankruptcy court determined, based on other evidence, that the market would set the value of the stock, the value of the stock could rise, and State Street would be adequately protected. Well, what is this other evidence? The district court doesn't say. UAL has never pointed to it. In fact, it does not exist. There is no evidence in the record that would say that the stock is going to have any value at the end of the day when this injunction expires. In fact, there is plenty of evidence that it'll be worthless.
If everybody knew it was going to be worthless in 3 years, why was it selling for a positive price at the time the ESOP tried to sell it?
Well,
do you think the professional investors who are responsible for setting these prices are all a bunch of suckers who just don't understand the way Chapter 11 reorganizations work?
No, they're not all a bunch of suckers, because every time the stock is sold, somebody makes
money.
They're
often referred to as vultures on the street. They're the smartest players, and they make a lot of money.
At the end of this day, game of musical chairs, however, the stock will be worthless. UAL has said it will be worthless, and what this injunction did was mean...
Why is it selling for a positive price? What's your economic
theory? It's the genius of the American system.
And so you think it's just kind of manna from heaven. There's a class of investors who specialize in bankrupt firms. They buy for a positive price stock that everybody knows is going to be worthless, and they become extremely wealthy. Where does their money come from?
I could only speculate.
I think you and modern finance theory need to get together.
Well, in answer to that, I can only say that whatever the reason that motivates these people to buy, State Street, as a fiduciary, had not only the right but the obligation to sell This was our duty to our beneficiaries. As long as there is a market out there, this is what we had to do. This is
as
what
I say, you and modern finance theory need to get together. There's actually some good work on the effect of modern finance theory on the obligations of trustees, and it does not suggest that trustees need to sell bankrupt firms. Take a look at some of John Langbein's work on this subject.
Thank you. I will do so.
The case is taken under advisement.